This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Ben Weingard. He's an assistant professor of psychology at Hillsdale College and also writes for Quillette. Ben, it's great speaking with you.
Yeah, nice to speak with you.
Can you give us some basic background information, and would you say that your main focus and interest is in evolutionary psychology?
Yeah, that's correct. I was a sociology major as an undergraduate, and was somewhat put off by the political activism there, because I already had an interest in doing an evolutionary analysis of human societies. So I was put off by that, and then I applied to explicit evolutionary psychology programs for graduate school. And then I worked with Dave Geary at the University of Missouri, and he specializes in children's mathematical development, but also in his spare time writes a lot about human sex differences. So that's where I got kind of my training and cut my teeth. And then I got a job at Carroll College in Montana and worked there for 3 years. And then I got this gig at Hillsdale.
And politically, you would say that you're both anti-woke and, but also anti-Trump?
Yeah, that is correct.
Did you ever identify with any political camp, or would you, or is it accurate to say that you're basically politically homeless?
No, so it's interesting. When I was, think about 20s, I discovered Noam Chomsky. So I kind of went through this radical Chomsky, Ralph Nader, a pretty far left stage. And then I moved kind of from there into what I would consider more of the mainstream of the Democratic Party, beginning in 2008, through probably most of the Obama administration. I had concerns about, you know, kind of left-wing wokeism, the identity politics, but I wasn't as attuned to how problematic it really was on the ground. So I would say it's only in the last 2 years or so that I really feel politically homeless.
And you are supporting Joe Biden. Is this primarily because of handling of issues in contrast to Trump, such as the pandemic, climate change, jobs, and the economy?
Yeah, and I would say supporting him is probably a bit strong. I don't feel...
So not support, just like, is it more that you would tepidly vote for him as the alternative to Trump?
Yes, and although, like, so my brother and I debate about this and discuss it quite a bit, and I have nothing against, and in fact completely understand, why somebody would vote for Trump, or at least against the Democratic Party. For me, how I weight the importance of certain issues, I think it is actually strategically to my advantage, or to the advantage of the causes that I believe in, to vote for Biden. So for example, some form of universal health care is extremely important to me. And there's no chance of that happening unless, at least in the next 4 years, unless Biden is elected. Climate change, I think, that's honestly an issue that I haven't spent that much time investigating for whatever reason. Like, I think the consensus is probably accurate. You know, anthropogenic climate change is very real and it's important. If for whatever reason, I just haven't got into it very deep. So that's not the primary reason. Universal healthcare, and even more so, just the fact that I think that Donald Trump is a profoundly incompetent executive and he's not serious. The only thing that you get from Trump is, you know, it's just culture war 24/7, because that's the only thing that he really knows how to do, kind of instinctively.
And as far as the outcome of the election, do you think if Biden's elected, there will be some degree of de-escalation in the rioting? Because the people engaged, like a lot of them, they do view Trump as the main villain, their main adversary? Or do you think it could very well continue?
So I think if anybody's being honest, you would have to admit a degree of uncertainty here, because there are obviously a lot of factors at play. If I had to bet, yes, I would predict that they would decline in intensity, although you probably would still have protests. They might become more peaceful, because for exactly the reason that you mentioned. I think Trump acts as a trigger for BLM, and importantly, what I think is important, Trump is such a hateful force that moderate Americans and suburban Americans who have very little sympathy for these protests have reported increasingly supporting BLM and supporting the idea that the United States suffers from systemic racism. Well, I don't think that that's an actual, like, well thought out or intellectualized belief. I think it's more of a look at Trump. He's kind of this loathsome figure. It must be the case that there's something going on here. Why are these people rioting? So I think if Biden is elected, wokeism will decline somewhat in the population, and the protests, a lot of the justification for them will be removed. And therefore, yeah, I do suspect some quieting of it. Now, that could be wrong. There is uncertainty, but that would be my best guess based on the information I have.
There's the civil unrest, and then there's just woke policies that could be institutionalized. So there's an assumption that there'll be more institutionalized of woke policies under Biden. So that could be like more types of affirmative action quotas, more intersectional education, like in academia, and possibly like a politicized prosecutions against like political adversaries. Or do you just think the momentum behind wokeness and woke capital to cancel culture, there is a strong momentum, so it seems it's going to be an issue regardless if it wins?
Yes. So there's a lot going on there. Just to address the particular point of would a Biden administration compared to a Trump administration institutionalize more of these, you know, like so-called like woke policies? Absolutely. Right. So that's something where I'm going to take a loss on that if he is elected. I'm assuming it'll be felt, especially in higher education. And it's a problem. Like there's just no way around that. You know, a kind of politics is the art of the possible. And again, like my complex calculus is Biden is better on issues I do care about. So, you know, I'll take it on that one. In terms of, but part of the reason I come to this calculation is because I think exactly what you were talking about is correct. There, people need to understand that wokeism is going nowhere. The major cultural institutions in our society have been nearly taken over, like mainstream establishment media, academia, higher education, Hollywood. Increasingly, these corporations like tech companies, even Wall Street. You see like this happening with, you know, Jamie Dimon, you know, bending the knee, etc. So regardless of who's elected, culturally, I think it's pretty safe to say we're going to move in a more woke direction. So another calculation that I make with Biden, now, again, I can be wrong on this, but I suspect you elect Biden, okay, immediately the conservative right unites around, their opposition to the Democratic Party. And that means opposition to wokeness as well. Then if you get this overreach on wokeism from the administration, there's going to be very strong pushback that's united. And I think in that case, the population would be sympathetic to a more moderate position because you don't have Trump as this figure that almost everybody can look at and kind of despise, right? So I suspect for that reason, it may move a little bit more slowly in the cultural front under Biden. Although, again, I concede that institutionally it will be worse. There's no doubt about that.
I mean, it does seem like a likely scenario. Trump has discussed using executive order against like critical race theory. But I just have a feeling a lot of that is just kind of talk to rally up his base. Like, a lot of it is just kind of keeping the media narrative about the culture war. But as far as like the riots go, yes. For a while there was some talk of the riots in Kenosha, Wisconsin, giving Trump like an edge in that state because yes. of how a lot of Democratic mayors have been correct. Handling their cities, and their cities are in chaos. But it is really hard to say like how much could that benefit Trump.
Well, so yeah, there again like quite a few issues. With the critical race theory stuff in the federal government, I support the ban of that, but I'm with you. I suspect that they won't actually move to concretely put that policy in place, and he's probably going to lose the election. At least all indication is that he will lose. So if he loses, clearly that's not going to happen. In terms of the protest, I actually think it's phenomenal that Trump hasn't been able to capitalize on that to his advantage. I mean, here you have the Democratic Party essentially supporting complete lawlessness and disorder, or at least not really calling it out strongly. I know Biden...
Yeah, the media, in a lot of cases, the media refuses to even use the term riots.
Right, absolutely. It's honestly hard for me to fathom like that level of woke kind of dishonesty from the media. Like, can you imagine if instead of BLM protesters and Antifa, these were Trump supporters and people with MAGA hats? We would be reading about how, you know, we were 2 days away from the, you know, Fourth Reich being instituted in the United States. It's just phenomenal. So I would think if there was anything that a conservative could capitalize on, it would be this type of fundamental breakdown in law and order. And yet, Trump is so incompetent and unable to actually function as a president that, as far as I can see in the polls, it hasn't done anything to help him.
Yeah, and just his like overall handling of the pandemic. Like, there was that release of the interview with Bob Woodward about him downplaying the virus.
Yes.
I think this is back in, but it was in the very beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah,
and then there's the economic aftermath. And just also kind of some of the ideological factors, because where Trump was successful in the beginning was this appeal to populism. But his handling of, like, the CARES Act, there was this, like, bailout of corporations, and it was a pretty measly stimulus for that most people got. And just kind of looking over Trump's administration, so earlier on, like, you did have like people like Peter Navarro, who mm-hmm. did have a more populist message.
Right.
And also Navarro, he did warn Trump to take the virus more seriously. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure his official role right now, but it does seem like he's been sidelined. So Trump's main economic advisor is Larry Kudlow, who's basically, he was from the Reagan administration, so he basically is a Reaganite who believes in supply-side economics, and that does seem to be the direction of Trump this election, as opposed to his original message, which was successful on populism.
Right, and so I think like there are two separate failings that are equally impressive to me, and equally have had, you know, tragic effects. So one would be the economic policies that the Trump administration has pursued since 2016. Then you have the pandemic failing. Well, I'll take the pandemic failing first. Now, I will admit that I'm you know, just a dilettante on this literature, and it's extremely complex. So it's hard to say what a good response to the pandemic would have done in terms of like concrete lives saved or how much better off the economy would be, right? But even setting that aside, I think we would agree that at bare minimum, to confront this effectively, you need to show leadership. And showing leadership means having an empathetic and morally serious response to it, right? Honestly communicating with the American people, like any other president would have done, you know, throughout the 20th century. Even, you know, figures like Nixon would be able to handle this just fine. So that would be your just minimal obligation if you're a serious president trying to handle this. He couldn't even meet that bar, right? As we see with this interview with Woodward, where he, you know, explicitly says, yeah, I'm lying to the American population because I don't want to cause a panic, or maybe I want the stock market to not crash. Even if that didn't cost any lives at all, I find that a just confusing and just morally repulsive response to that, to just lie to people when all you had to do is say, look, this is really serious, right? I'm instructing people to take precautions. And, you know, Trump has millions of hardcore followers. People would have listened to him at a time when a lot of people were not taking this seriously. They may well have, and they could have altered their daily routines. And that might have, you know, made a big difference. And it's interesting because if you look at the polling on political figures, say just within the United States, so you get figures like, you familiar with Gretchen Whitmer?
The governor of Michigan?
Yeah, and I'm in the state of Michigan, so it's kind of a salient example. So she's in this extremely divisive figure in the state of Michigan and nationally, just because I think she's a kind of rose as this anti-Trump type figure who was also a woman. She's made countless mistakes during this process, and I think a lot of the executive orders in the state of Michigan have been capricious and not based on science. However, she's received a bump in popularity that's been sustained, and I think the reason that's happened is because citizens and residents of Michigan are okay with some blundering, provided that the leader is actually taking it seriously and showing empathy and trying to do the best thing, right? The right thing by the public. But Trump's the only, I mean, there might be a few state governors, but Trump's, as far as I know, like the only major political figure, even comparatively with like figures like Trudeau in Canada, et cetera, who didn't receive any bump in popularity from the pandemic because his response was so just completely incompetent.
It will be interesting to see kind of the long-term trends and implications of this election. I did see this poll that showed there is this massive decline in conservatism, especially among like millennials and Zoomers. And then what would replace that? And is there going to be some kind of liberal hegemony? Looking at the Democratic Party, the momentum in that party is just so behind the woke agenda. I don't see that. I don't really see that changing. And then there's also the economic divide in the Democratic Party between the neoliberal donor class and a more stronger like left-wing economic policy. The economic trends are a bit harder, but I do see it's inevitable, almost inevitable, that there will be, that wokeness will be the driving force behind the Democratic Party for the next couple of decades. And then what will happen with, like, the GOP? Like, would they be open to, like, embracing, like, a mild, maybe, like, a mild version of socialism, stronger on, like, the national interest, but I could see maybe, like, less, not particularly socially conservative, like, similar to a lot of, like, a lot of European kind of right politicians, like, sort of like Marine Le Pen, like, seeing the GOP going more in that direction, and then obviously, like, the economic anxieties will likely continue to increase with the pandemic going on, but then longer term with trends like automation. So what are your general thoughts on the political trends for both parties?
Woo, yeah, big topics, but... So just to take the Republican Party, so I kind of find this interesting because I suspect if it weren't for the unique history with slavery and Jim Crow and the kind of racial divisiveness in the United States, I suspect the right-wing conservative party would be more populist already. Though that's a complex argument to lay out. What I do know, or what we know, and you're familiar with as well, is that when Trump was elected, he was specifically elected because he bucked the kind of neoliberal Ryan Romney Reagan wing of the Republican Party, right? So he had this more populist economic perspective. He was hostile toward immigration, and you could kind of see that combined in this synthetic populist agenda. Instead of any kind of economic victory for his base, what did they do when he went? So you try to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and you pass tax cuts for wealthy people and corporations. But, like, what does the average, like, rural Michigander care about the carried interest loophole? Of course not, right? So Trump delivered nothing except for he tweets hostile tweets toward people that rural and downwardly mobile whites despise, right? So he plays on kind of white grievance.
Yeah, he does pander that, but he hasn't really offered them anything concrete or beneficial to their interests.
That's exactly right. So, and I mean, from the perspective of the Republican donor class, you know, like the Kochs and these other, you know, extremely wealthy capitalists, that's great, right? Yeah, send out the tweets, you know, tweet about Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post and media elites and pass economic policies that benefit us, right? I'm sure they're quite content to have that happen. And in fact, there's a, I think it's a good book. I know I've had some debates with people about it, but there's a book called Let Them Eat Tweets by Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson. And they're both on the left and a little bit woke. However, I think the analysis is pretty sound, and they just make the argument that this, we could kind of consider this plutocratic populism. Right. So it's got this populist veneer and populist rhetoric. But if you look at the policies from 2016 to now, it's just straightforward, you know, Republican, run-of-the-mill Republican policies. That's it. So that would be like my a little bit of the thought. I could get into more detail on that, on what's going on in the GOP.
As far as long-term trends, like, do you think that the GOP could be closer, become closer to some of those, like, European-type parties, like, kind of a nation-focused, like, populist parties, or do you think that the donor in class is just too powerful and the kind of Reaganite to Bush era, that conservative ideology is too entrenched?
No, so I think this is one thing that I will give Trump credit for. I think he demonstrated quite clearly that if you have a popular agenda that really activates your base, the donor class be damned, right? Like, if Trump were not constitutionally lazy, he could have, on the day after he took office, said, here's what we're going to do. we're going to do infrastructure. I'm going to get Republicans on board, because if they don't get on board, I'm going to go to their districts and campaign against them, right, and call them out. He could have proposed some kind of, like, the whatever the kind of conservative, like, Republican version of, like, a New Deal, like, agenda would be for rural, small town and ex-urban America. Like, hey, we're going to fix, like, these towns that are going backwards, or where you're having this brain drain, or where jobs have fled. And you could have included in that, like, one major piece of that could have been a promise to end the opioid epidemic. Well, that's 60,000 people a year who are dying. You don't think that would have been popular among Trump's base? I mean, get real. Like, he would have been able to steamroll the other Republicans who got in the way there. And he would have been able to get Democrats, not all, but some Democrats on board, because what Democrat is going to go against infrastructure or more spending for drug treatment, right? So you can when you imagine what he could have done and how popular that could have been, there could have been a true populist realignment in 2016, 2017, where the GOP, you would say, that was the moment they became the populist party, and there's no going back. Right now, I suspect that you're right, that they will move in that direction. They're kind of groping in that direction. But it's going to take a forceful, charismatic figure, I think, to kind of complete that. Just like you would say, it took, like, the Democratic Party was moving more pro-worker with, like, Al Smith, but it really took FDR and the Great Depression before it became clear that the Democratic Party was, in fact, the party of the working class. So I think you'll have to have this charismatic figure, whether that's, Tom Cotton, Josh Hawley, Marco Rubio, somebody we haven't heard of yet. I'm not sure. And I will just lay in my cards on the table. That's what I want to see. That's the party that I would vote for.
Because you actually said on Twitter that you don't see yourself as having any future in the Democratic Party as things are going now with the culture war stuff and cancel culture.
Yeah, that's correct. I absolutely do not see that past 2024. So you had mentioned, I mean, if you think about this, so one of the most amazing maps to me that I've ever seen is this New York Times, I think it was published sometime in 2017, maybe 2018, but they published this extremely detailed map of the 2016 election. And it's not just by county, you can go down to the precinct level. Okay. So one thing you noticed about it immediately when you zoom in is that basically the entire United States is red, right? Except for it's pockmarked by dense urban areas that are Democrat. And even within a city, it's the closer you get to the central city, the more Democrat it is, the bluer it is. Okay. Now, what does that tell you? Well, it tells you the Democrats are now, you know, completely an urban party. They're the party of the creative class, the professional managerial class, the winners of globalization. Okay. Now, when you think about, well, what is a party, a political party, that where their base is increasingly made up of hyper-educated urban elites, what kind of policies are they going to favor? Are they going to favor policies that help rebuild small towns, rural environments, smaller communities that are less connected to the global world? No, of course they're not going to. Right? They're going to support policies that favor the interests of the elite, global capital, right? Free movement of capital, immigration, investing in universities, innovation. So not all of it's bad. Like, I am favorable toward investing in innovation and research and universities. But some of it, I think, is very destructive, right? I really think that just going all out on abandoning the white working class is a terrible idea. I think it's morally wrong, but I also think it's just for the future of the United States. That's not a good way to move forward.
So we did have this kind of the Great Awakening and then the woke capital trend of the business interest supporting that. But to what degree do you see it as taking off as a reaction to Trump? Because I'm sure you know who Zach Goldberg is.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And he's posted those graphs that have showed these like woke buzzwords. They were already taking off during the Obama era.
That's right. So the question is, to what extent did Trump excel? Yeah. It's a really hard question to answer, because I think Goldberg, I mean, that data, you look at it, it's like, yeah, it's kind of hard to refute the fact that these trends were already well in swing in, 2012, especially. I think that was kind of an inflection point for whatever reason. So I suspect that what Trump has done is made more of the extreme wokeism more palatable to moderates and relatively uninformed voters and citizens. And so, like, a lot of this, the anti-racism, critical race theory, kind of bizarre wokeism that you encounter in academia, it's so ridiculous and patently absurd that the average person, if you tried to, explain this to them, they would immediately just think, well, that's twaddle. But you get a figure like Trump, who's as repugnant as he is and as incompetent as he is, and then you see, these protests, you see all of this, like, the disgusting rhetoric from him, from other people who are associated with him, the rise of the like, not just the, like, soft alt-right, but, like, the actual, like, ethno-nationalist hardcore alt-right. And then you take this average person who cares about their community, who's fine with, ethnic diversity, or at least reasonably, okay with it. And yeah, they're going to be a little bit more amenable to that because, it's like, well, if there's not systemic racism, or if the police actually don't disproportionately murder innocent blacks, then why is all of this happening, right? It readily makes sense of that. So I suspect that if we were looking at the main cultural institutions like academia, the media, Hollywood, it probably didn't do a lot there because they were already getting taken over by the younger generation who already had these kind of extreme woke views. So it was kind of inevitable. And I think, again, like, Goldberg's data does show that that's the case, that it really didn't. I mean, if you didn't know 2016 was the election of Trump, when you looked at Goldberg's data, it wouldn't even stand out to you.
And then with, woke capital, there's one theory that it was deliberately done to distract from the income inequality and, like, economic and class angle. But then there's a more general, view that it was just the natural result of, like, all those, like, college graduates from elite universities going into the corporate world.
Yes. I mean, that's obviously going to be a complex issue, but I think the most parsimonious way to look at it is just institutionally, that I don't think there's any conspiracy, like, people are deliberately doing this to divide the working class or push these economic policies, increase inequality, and then kind of hide that from people. I think it's just, institutionally, it has the effect, right, of diverting people's attention somewhat from economic inequality. So it's functionally advantageous. And it's also probably true, right, that if you looked in these corporations, like in the HR departments or in upper level management, they also probably sincerely share those woke views and really sincere. Like, I have no doubt Jeff Bezos really sincerely believes that there is a lot of racism right now. It's ubiquitous, and that some kind of anti-racist approach is appropriate. And he's probably favorable toward affirmative action He's probably favorable toward reparations. So here's another thing that, and I'd be interested to see what you think about this. I suspect the Democratic Party, they're going to become just more explicitly the party of elite white liberals and people of color, and they're going to redistribute income through affirmative action, reparations, and other such kind of racial...
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. So a way to redistribute wealth where it's done racially rather than class-based so that it doesn't impact their economic interests.
Absolutely,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, I could very likely see that happening. Yeah, even though, I mean, you support Biden tepidly, you think that could happen under Biden, but especially like if Kamala Harris becomes president, I could definitely see those policies.
Yeah, I have a hard time believing. I don't doubt that a Biden administration would seriously look at a reparations type bill, or maybe depending on the mood of the country, maybe even like float it. I really have a tough time believing that you could do anything concrete to actually get that through, at least in the next 4 years. Sometime in the future, yeah, like under a Harris, yeah, I could imagine that. But one thing I think to think about that is important, and I've discussed this with a few other people as well, that if you think about it, if you're like one of these woke capitalists, you know, like Tim Cook or Jeff Bezos, you're much more favorable toward, well, first of all, redistribution that's perceived to be based on racial justice, because you actually sincerely believe in that, right? One. Two, you're much more you have a more favorable attitude toward that kind of redistribution that doesn't fundamentally affect the organization of capitalism than you would to, say, like the rise of a new union movement, right? So these corporations would be willing to take a tax hit if it meant they could just continue business as usual, continue to grab market share, not have to worry about being regulated with any more scrutiny, and not have to worry about policies that would increase the bargaining power of workers. If that's the trade that they have to make, they'll absolutely do that, right? So I think you're right that the Bernie Sanders version of the Democratic Party, even though I know he's not, you know, technically a Democrat, but that Sanders kind of Warren vision will almost surely get turned into a more performative woke vision with some redistribution that helps mostly Hispanics and African Americans. I have no doubt of that. And I'm not even saying that it's like morally bad. I mean, I think there are moral qualms about it, but just look at the voting. I mean, who votes Democrat now? Educated whites and people of color. I mean, what would you expect?
Yeah, so it would be educated whites plus people of color in the Democratic Party. So
right.
Then the Republican Party would be left over pretty much. It would be like white people who make less than $100,000 a year.
Yes, although there's this interesting, in the polling data, this is kind of interesting, and I've heard, I think Matt Iglesias talked about this a little bit on the Weeds podcast, that if you look at it, Trump actually does surprisingly well among blacks and Hispanics, specifically black and Hispanic men. So you could kind of see a little bit of intersexual analysis might be interesting, where if the Republican Party does truly become a working class party, they would be able to pick off, I think, a lot of working class African Americans and Hispanics. And there are a lot of working class members in those communities, right? We kind of forget this because we're just told, oh, the white working class. I've even kind of used that discourse a little bit. But if you think about the word working class broadly, right, it's very diverse. And I could imagine a savvy populist figure capitalizing on that.
I could kind of see that too. I think with the GOP, their kind of minority outreach like in the past. It has been kind of like basically the continuation of the kind of donor class type conservative economic policies,
yeah,
with some like a milder version of kind of woke ethnic pandering. And that GOP strategy, like Jeb Bush would epitomize that, that's been a failure. But I mean, I basically agree with you that I think if the GOP were to become a working class party, it would have a broader demographic appeal. As far as where things are going, like, what are your thoughts on this idea of America, this period where we were talking about becoming a colorblind nation, and then the role that identity politics, but also kind of ethnic fragmentation, will play in the future?
So this actually kind of depends on what day you ask me. I'm somewhat convinced that the absolute triumph of wokeism is inevitable. It's kind of like the rise of Christianity in the Roman Empire. And if that happens, you will get a lot of ethnic fragmentation. The idea of doing like any like colorblind institutions, maybe even like law would be somewhat
Really like pretty extreme examples. Ridiculous too, like the intersectional inclusion and quotas for the Academy Awards. Then there's this high school in San Francisco doing like the anti-racism assessment, which that does seem to like violate the privacy of the students.
It does. It absolutely does. And then I saw some ridiculous example where a university was collecting racial data about the partners of their faculty. Which just strikes me as, I find any of those diversity statements when you're applying for a job or anything, just, it's insulting. I don't fill them out because I find it just insulting. To me, it's like, okay, well, what happens here? You get this kind of woke coalition, like the Obama coalition on steroids, increasing anti-racism, wokeness, affirmative action policies, reparations, that inevitably, even if you like a lot of those policies, what you have to do, I think it's important to be pragmatic here. Inevitably, that will increase white identity. There's just no way to avoid that because it makes racial identity salient. And as whites become more of a minority, they feel threatened. And that just will happen. There's just, again, like, even if you don't like, if you just wish every race besides whites could emphasize their own racial identity and take pride in that, bad idea, pragmatically, right? So if you have that happen and then you get a rise of white grievance, white identity, that's a recipe for extreme, I just don't want to see the country go down that road. But I think...
Where certain identity politics are encouraged, but where white identity politics is viewed as reprehensible, were you talking about a scenario where just basically every group is just looking out and fighting for their own tribe?
For their tribe, specifically though, it's not going to be their tribe based on like class, socioeconomic status, or geography. It's going to be specifically based on race. And yes, I mean, maybe you disagree with me, but I just don't see how do you have this group that's going to become a minority at some point? How does their ethnic identity not become activated when they see all of these other groups explicitly pushing their own ethnic interests?
Yeah, I do see that happening, like, if there's practical benefits, because if there's these draconian, say, affirmative action restrictions that make it difficult to have work, then it's going to be natural for you to organize, like, with your own in-group and then figure out, like, maybe some kind of, like, economic guild. How groups throughout history that have felt marginalized will create their own institutions to look out for their economic needs.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, so you'll often get the kind of counter or the criticism to that, well, like, look, like, in the United States, white people are extremely privileged. They're only losing, you know, some relative status. It's not as if they're going to be actually, like, economically displaced, etc. To that, I would say, sure. So if you want to be transparent and make that argument politically, go for it. You'll lose, one. Two, it doesn't matter because what people perceive is the relative status. That's what psychologically matters to them, right? So even if you think, well, it's justified to put, you know, like these privileged whites in their place a little bit, it's just, it doesn't have a salubrious effect on society. It just won't. So if to me, my preference personally, I mean, people have to make their own decisions and do their own analyses, but my preference is for a truly colorblind society in the sense that, not that there's no racism among the population, that's impossible, right? Like human nature, in the sense that institutions work in a colorblind way, right?
So they, you're saying, so people as individuals, they might have their own in-group bias, but the main institutions, obviously government, academia, and major corporations, should be colorblind.
Absolutely, and I think this is important because if you live in a truly liberal society with liberal principles, it really doesn't matter what a particular individual, like what their view of a different, you know, religious faiths or, you know, races or socioeconomic classes is. Like, that individual is free to do whatever he or she wants within the confines of the law to live wherever he or she wants. If you have this view that, like, Aryans are the dominant race, and you want to go move to, you know, rural Montana with other people who have that view, be my guest. I find that morally repugnant, but it doesn't threaten the actual fabric of society. It's just these individuals engaging in their right to associate with whomever they please. If an institution does that, it's completely different. So my point is, yes, public, private institutions are colorblind. The law is colorblind. The criminal justice system is colorblind. I mean, again, this is like an ideal type, right? Obviously, it's never going to be 100%, but you want to work as hard as you can to instantiate that in these institutions. And I fear that it's already too late to do that. And if it's not now, certainly it's going to be in the next, like, say, you know, 5 to 10 years or so.
Yeah, I would basically agree with that. I think, unfortunately, we've kind of reached, like, the tipping point of no return. And there was a brief period in maybe the 80s or 90s where we were going in that direction, but I don't really see it in the future. I do see more, like, fragmentation along sectarian lines. Can you give us your thoughts on the situations with wokeness and academia canceling? And can you also talk about your brother, Bo, the situation where he was terminated from a position as a professor?
Yeah, so you want me to start with just, like, academia in general?
Oh, yeah.
So, academia is obviously it's a tough place right now for people who are, you know, relatively unwoke or kind of, you know, part of the old, I would consider it kind of more the old school, like, working class left, that would identify with, like, the New Deal, or the dissident left, I guess you use that term. I think it's rough because if you don't get on board with this,
if you're from the old left, you're put in the same category as a Trump supporter.
Oh, absolutely. Because if you have the view that there might be, like, racial disparities in important outcomes that have nothing to do with discrimination or systemic racism, you're looked at as if you were morally repugnant, right? And you can't even talk about this stuff, honestly. I mean, we've seen what has happened time and time again to intellectuals and pundits who try. I mean, Charles Murray, what happened to him, right? So the situation in academia is quite dire. I'm at Hillsdale College, which is an explicitly conservative college, liberal arts college, doesn't take any federal funding, so they're able to be quite independent. And, you know, they have their own issues, as any institution does, but it is a breath of fresh air to not have to worry about you know, all of the woke issues and have it pretty much just kind of common background is that people should be treated as individuals. So this is my third year at Hillsdale, and as I'm here longer, I'll probably get a little bit more removed from like what it would be like if I were at a regular liberal arts college. So it's a little bit hard for me to say day to day, but I think it will get to the point pretty soon where if you have any kind of heterodox views on race and gender or LGBTQ issues, you'll either keep them to yourself completely or you will not try to get a job at least in the social sciences. That's what I suspect. And I know that seems, you know, maybe perhaps extreme, but I just look at people like Colin Wright, who, I mean, his views to me are just saying like banal things like, yeah, sex is real, right? And it's like controversial.
How much of a taboo is there to break away from blank slateism? Like, I guess like the term would be like HBD or birealism.
Yeah, so I would make a distinction. Like, I think that the consensus view, I mean, certainly in psychology, is not that humans are a blank slate. I think that's just intellectually not defensible. So you might find true blank slatists in sociology or anthropology. I don't know. I can't, you know, I'm not an expert. I can't speak to that as much. I think... There's a distinction between most people or most psychologists would accept that there is this kind of biologically rich human nature and that there is some innate coding, if you will, in the brain mind. Where they would depart and where you really get into trouble is if you say that there is any genetic basis to group differences.
So if you explicitly were to say that like one ethnic group has a higher IQ, that's very taboo in academia.
Yeah, so if you said, okay, the average one standard deviation IQ gap between blacks and whites is, let's say, 25 to 50% genetic, I think that would be enough to, depending on who you were, you know, how much attention got thrown on it, it'd be probably enough to get you fired if you didn't have tenure, or certainly to mount a campaign against that. I mean, it is interesting. Like the last real mainstream figure with mainstream credibility who really investigated the hereditarian hypothesis was Arthur Jensen. And, you know, that's a decade ago since he produced any peer-reviewed research. I mean, he died in, I think it was 2012.
You made an interesting point, I think, just from Twitter, that you said a lot of this despair and depression in our society comes from the idea that we're all told that we can rise to the top and accomplish anything regardless of the genes we're born with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is true, and I think there's a special concern about, well, what if people believe that some of the race differences we see are biological? Like, wouldn't that be horrible? Right?
Yeah, it would completely change the whole discussion that we're having about inequality.
Yeah, I think that there is that belief among, like, woke liberals that would in fact happen. I suspect, personally, that's just not true. I just don't think it might be. I mean, that's not a reason to not actually discuss the topics, but I suspect just as an empirical matter that not much would change even if there was widespread acceptance of the hereditarian hypothesis. Now, in terms of individuals and rising to the top, I agree. Yeah, I think that's right. I think we should do a better job of teaching adolescents and children, and parents for that matter.
So besides just the whole genetic angle, you're just talking about the kind of the culture that we have where everyone is told when they're a kid that they can all become like a millionaire. That is ingrained right. in our culture.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And my thought on that is, like, I understand why we do that. I understand why parents would do that. I understand why teachers would do that. But I think a much more salubrious message, and one that's more defensible scientifically, and I actually think just from a normative perspective, I find it more morally appealing, is to tell people, like, our goal is to help all individuals maximize their potential in whatever domains they feel passionate about.
Yeah, I also think that, like, the economic system and education academia should be focused more on specialization. Well, I know in Germany how their education system works is actually pretty rigid. How you get into a certain school and it's harder to move on. But there'd be, like, ideally there'd be flexibility. I guess everything is kind of spread out. You do a little bit of math, a little bit of English, maybe a little, some business skills. But I think, like, starting in high school, like, helping people identify what their strengths are, their skills, and even factoring in their psychological profile, and then helping them find a economic niche based on those traits.
Yes. So what I would say, I mean, this is all, like, obviously we're dealing with broad, complex topics, and I'm not an expert across the board. So if anything I say is, like, not correct, that's fine. I'm just throwing out kind of my thoughts based on how I view the literature. So if we're talking about people who have an IQ, let's say 120 plus, I don't think it really matters that much how they're educated, because they're going to figure out on their own what they're good at and what they're interested in, and they're going to gravitate toward that. And I think they'll be okay. You probably, you know, you should have some sense of your limitation, and you should be taught that that's not a bad thing, that, you know, look, if you're only, you know, like, if you make it to the top 95th percentile, and that's as good as you can do, that's fine. Like, you, if you worked as hard as you could, you should be proud of that. Now, where I have real concerns, though, are, well, what do we do with people who have IQs, like, you know, average or below? Right. And now, by definition, in the white population, right, half of the population is going to be below 100, basically. So what do you do? That's a large group of people. And that's where I think you're right, that trying to figure out more of a specialization, a trade, something that can provide a job that gives them a sense of meaning and dignity. Because I think, like, one of my sacred values that I have is that everybody kind of deserves this sense of having dignity. And what you have to ask yourself is, you know, like, say right now, how much dignity do you feel like you have if you're working in an Amazon warehouse?
And you just see that, like, how suicide rates, how they're growing exponentially. That just proves that there's not a culture of dignity.
I think that's right. And I think the... I mean, I don't want to blame liberal elites for every problem in society, but I think there is a problem in that liberal elites actually do, for the most part, view these people in a condescending way. They view them as kind of rubes, and, you know, often they're, you know, they have backwards retrograde beliefs, they have silly religious beliefs, they're kind of, they have some vestigial racism or unsavory views about gender norms. And then you get these people and they take a job. You're not getting paid that much. The hours are pretty brutal. It's not a job that confers any status or dignity to you. And you don't have any conceivable, like, option for upward mobility. And then this, like, high, like, 140 IQ elite just says, well, you should learn to code. Everybody can do that.
Oh, yeah.
Code, and then get hired by Microsoft. As if that's feasible, right?
It's obviously not, but it's also, it's an economic issue. Then also, like, it deals with culture and status. Can you talk about the case with your brother, Bo, in academia?
Oh, absolutely. So he was a professor at Marietta College in Southern Ohio. And he's talked about human biological diversity, including being quite open and honest about his view that the hereditarian hypothesis is more than likely correct, but wanting to have civil, you know, good-natured dialogue about it. And he, you know, is active on Twitter, has a quite a large Twitter following, I mean, relative to academics, that is. And I think having that large following was somewhat of his undoing, because they, some of these individuals who don't like him started an email campaign against him by emailing the people at Marietta College, like the president and I think the board of trustees. And then a kind of big step was that my brother went to, he was invited to give a talk, I think at the University of Alabama, and he has a rational wiki page. So people read it. I don't know if it was an academic or some students who read it initially and then kind of spread it around.
Oh, I think so, he's like, they put him under the category of the old center.
Yeah, and I don't even know really what that means, to be honest.
I've actually discussed this on my show and past shows, but the alt center is a political sphere that's sort of in between the alt-left and the alt-right, the space in between that.
Okay.
So it's basically centrism, but like radically anti-establishment.
Okay.
But then also at the Rational Wiki type, they'll mention that alt centrists tend to believe in like biological realism.
Right. Well, for whatever you know, set of reasons, this combination of the Twitter hate that he was getting, combined with the Rational Wiki page probably calling him, you know, a hereditarian, you know, believing in race realism and scientific racism, this talk just did not go well. You know, students were not particularly happy about it. It kind of triggered some people. Some of the faculty, even the individual who invited him to give the talk, kind of became a little bit, you know, backed off of supporting him, essentially. And so he had that situation, and then that kind of intensified the campaign. And I think it was a month or two later, I remember I was like, it was 15 minutes before my class started, and he called me, was just like, yeah, I just got fired. And I couldn't believe it. I really did not think that they would do that. I thought that they would wait, right? And like, he would go through like maybe a third year review or something, and maybe they would try to push him out that way. I did not think they would just not renew his contract for his third year. So I was really shocked, and then I had to go lecture, and it was a little bit tough. But after that, I mean, that kind of really did have an effect on me. Like, it cleared my head a little bit, I think, of some of the more moderate views I had of academia, where, yeah, it's not great, but it's not that bad. People like this don't have power. I'll be okay. People in, you know, traditional, you know, universities and colleges are, for the most part, protected. Well, no, they're not. And that made it very clear. And I found it especially disgusting to see these kind of woke people on Twitter in academia not defending on principle.
This is a huge issue, and there really hasn't been any political solution, not just academics, but with people getting fired for their views in general. Like, there hasn't been any political solution that's tangible that's been put out.
Yeah, and I do want to say, I think it's particularly disgusting in academia, because there is this expectation that you have academic freedom, that you as long as you're seriously engaging with the scholarship and trying to contribute to the knowledge base, you're given wide berth to have provocative, controversial ideas and to explore the implications of those ideas, and of course to receive critical feedback. But the idea that you would get fired for respectfully having these discussions and having debates about them and not have people defend that on principle is absolutely amazing to me. Like, you can disagree with my brother all you want. You can think he's a terrible human being. You can think his writing is atrocious. I think his prose tends to be a little bit purple sometimes myself. Right? That's fair game. Saying you should fire somebody for that, it's just reprehensible. And those people just out themselves as basically, you know, like little like woke despots, right? And what's so disconcerting is exactly what you said. Nothing happens to them, right? You can be that kind of illiberal in academia and actually just be fine. People will leave you alone for the most part. And yeah, that's a real problem, because what you would like to happen is my brother gets fired or somebody else. I mean, you know, don't take him. Let's say somebody's extremely critical of Israel. Okay? They get fired for that. What you would like to have happen is all of the people who were responsible for that and who supported that get absolutely shamed, right? So that other people are less incentivized to do that. I mean, you should honestly like just feel nothing but shame for doing that. And again, that's whether I agree with the professor or the, you know, the faculty member or not. It doesn't matter. Like, I would support anybody's right to explore these ideas. You could write an article about a moral defense of murdering police officers, and I would defend to my death the right for you to explore that and have a conference based on it and write papers based on it. Now, if you're violating the law, different story. But if you're just doing like a moral exploration, like let's think about this.
Like a thought experiment. Or that, yeah. That kind of reminds me, because like the controversy with Richard Dawkins, was talking about eugenics. He didn't say he wants to implement it. He just gave out a short thought experiment and that was enough. That there's countless cases in academia or just in general where just thought experiments are enough to get you in trouble.
Yeah, and actually, I think in the case of Dawkins, now I might be misremembering, but if I recall correctly, all that happened was he said it actually would work. Well, obviously, because natural selection has worked. Like, I mean, to me, that's like, really? You're pushing back on the idea that you could use selective breeding. I mean, that is what natural selection is. The idea that you have variation, you know, differential reproduction and heredity. And that if you decided, we're just going to have people with over a 140 IQ, you know, mate with each other, that the population IQ would increase. That is a factual statement. I don't know how you could deny that. Now,
yeah, he just said it would work, but that the
exactly.
That the ethical issues of the implementation were not worth it, or potentially human rights abuses.
Yeah, like, look, if you believe in liberalism, as I do, I mean, other people are free to, you know, if they want to become a fascist or an integralist or something, that's their prerogative. But I'm a firm liberal, classical liberal principles. If you believe in that, you find the idea of state-coerced eugenics despicable. It's despicable. Not because it wouldn't work. It might work, right? It's despicable because it's coercive, right? So that's exactly what Dawkins was saying, is again, like, the problem is the ethics of that are horrendous. Not that it's empirically, like, poppycock or something, because again, yeah, it's not. And I agree with you completely. You should be able to entertain controversial thought experiments, because that's how often humans make moral progress, by thinking about these kind of unnatural situations or situations that would elicit a strong disgust or a kind of well, that's violating this taboo that I have, this response, this visceral response, and you override that, right? So there are a lot of provocative thought experiments that I know ethicists will use surrounding like abortion, or, you know, like the trolley problem. There are hundreds of derivations of that. Academia is the place for that. The one place in society, I think, where any of these ideas, like, they're not beyond the pale. Now, you can make a distinction, I think, between somebody who's seriously grappling with the literature in his or her discipline and being responsible about that, and somebody who's completely incompetent and just throwing ideas out that have been completely discredited.
Ben, we're at the end of the show. Is there anything you'd like to plug about any projects that you have, and do you want to plug your fascination with capybaras?
I would love to plug, well, first of all, let me just plug like a, what is I think perhaps platitudinous or trite, but I have a real faith in humanity. I love Western civilization. I love the basic principles of classical liberalism, and I'm willing to fight for those. And if I lose on that, so be it, but I will fight for those principles. That's what I would plug, is a deep love of the rule of law, limited government, individual autonomy, individual rights. And that, by the way, that's consistent with everything from, you know, like kind of neoliberal capitalism to some extent, to like Scandinavian social democracy. So there's wide berth to your specific views with those principles. Capybaras, just absolutely lovable, fascinating creatures. I encourage everybody to look them up on YouTube, to follow my Twitter feed to see more of them. And then I also just wanted to give a shout out to otters, which I just discovered otters, and they are fascinating creatures. I will have more of those on my Twitter thread over the next, you know, few months. Also will plug the season of autumn. I really love autumn, the change of leaves, and I will be definitely posting more pictures, hopefully beautiful pictures of like the Upper Peninsula in Michigan as the leaves start to turn.
Ben Weingard, it has been an excellent show. Thanks for being on.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.